But we start this week with Robin Gray, who's doing a play now. What is it? Did I get it right? Is it 3 acres and a cow, Robin?
Yes, 3 acres and a cow. The full title is 3 acres and a cow, a history of land rights and protest in folk song and story.
So what is the significance of this term, 3 acres and a cow?
3 acres and a cow was a slogan of the land reform movement in the late 1800s. At that point in history, you know, people had been cleared off the land during the Industrial Revolution and the parliamentary enclosures within living memory. And they, you know, really hoped that they'd be able to repopulate the countryside and move out of the cities and towns. And 3 acres and a cow was the amount that was decided that was sort of, you know, an amount that a family could quite happily be self-sufficient on at that period in history.
So why didn't they just want to carry on working in the factories?
I think that the long hours, the conditions, the lack of seasonality, and you know how controlling they found it meant that it was quite highly undesirable for the vast majority of people, not to mention the fact that the living conditions in towns and cities at that time was kind of what we would think of now as some of the worst slums and shanty towns in the third world.
That's right. I mean, it's a bit like what's happened in China more recently. A lot of people moving out from the countryside, from a very simple existence, into factories and things in the city, then suddenly finding that economic conditions aren't so good, they're not being paid so much, and starting to think about actually returning back to the countryside. Also, it's William Blake's Jerusalem hymn, isn't it, where he talks about the dark satanic mills. So I wonder,
absolutely,
if they were looking back towards the countryside, was there any success there? I mean, people had already been moved out of the countryside, but they're looking at returning there.
Yeah, I mean, there were some successes. I think many more in Ireland as a result of the Irish Land League, and, you know, they had a bit more of an extreme situation, and obviously, you know, the horrendous famine that they had, and so they were a little bit more motivated and bold with their agitation than was realised by English, Scottish and Welsh brethren.
So tell us about the play, 3 Acres and a Cow. Do you bring a cow on stage?
No, we don't, and I don't tend to call it a play. I tend to keep it more as a show or performance. I mean, it really aims to be like a cross between a TED talk, a folk club sing-along, a fireside storytelling session and a poetry slam. It really, and wherever I go in the country with the show, we always try and get local performers to come and bring their local stories and songs to the show. So it changes, you know, most times, and it's been evolving over the course of the last 2 or 3 years as a lot of the information and detail in the show is sort of crowdsourced off people who've seen the show.
So how do you, if you're starting off a show, you're saying you haven't actually got a script that you're working from?
We don't have a script, no. I've had to jot down a few thoughts now because I've actually just finished a project to develop a performer's kit so that I can take on apprentices and train other people up to be able to do the show. And that's meaning I am starting to have to script some elements of it just so other people can learn it, because obviously they don't have 3 years to sit and read books and research it in quite the depth that I've gone. But you know, most of the time there's I'm kind of just reacting to the things I've read recently and sort of drawing a narrative through 1,000 years of history and making people realize that history isn't just memorizing dates and knowing what the kings and queens were up to. Actually, you can, you know, really connect and resonate with what people were up to over that 1,000 years.
But I mean, you know, we're living a very fast-paced existence, modern laptops, a lot of people with a high-stress lifestyle, working all the hours God sends in the cities, overcrowded. I mean, how relevant is what you're saying for today? I'd imagine quite a lot of people would be looking at it and thinking, well, this is a million miles away from the modern world.
Yeah, no, those are good questions. I mean, I think one of the things, there's a few really strong messages that we try and get across at the end. One of the things is, you know, if you're campaigning for something or you're trying to fight for your rights, if you look at history, it's really important to realize that, you know, you might not get to see the fruits of that battle in your lifetime. You know, you never know when the seeds that you plant are going to bear fruit. So, you know, I think there's a lot of hope in that, because a lot of the time people just have this sort of Hollywood heroes narrative where one person comes along, fights against all odds, everybody starts following them and they save the day and ride off into the sunset on horseback. And so it's just starting to tell people some different stories and narratives and times when, you know, we have won rights and we have won battles and times when they've been lost as well, and just what, you know, what that looks like from a much more sort of real and historical perspective.
Now, in the modern world, I mean, we here in Bristol, we've got Cabot Circus, which used to be public land, public property, public streets, policed by ordinary police. Now it's private police. It's all been privatised, and it's a giant private shopping centre. That's a good example of privatisation of our streets and of our land.
Absolutely. I mean, enclosure is definitely still happening. It's just moved into the towns and cities and also into intellectual property, such as seeds and things. You know, they're trying to, you know, copyright and enclose, you know, DNA in the genome and seeds and stuff. So, you know, just understanding the historical processes of land enclosure can really connect up and be very, very relevant to a lot of the battles that are being fought today.
Okay, well, take us back a few hundred years, maybe before the English Civil War. How was land managed out in the countryside before it was enclosed or privatised?
So the form of land ownership at that time was much more cooperatively managed. The land was called the commons, and the idea was that everybody had rights to be able to grow food and forage for wood and keep some animals on that common land. And this was kind of left over from Anglo-Saxon models of land ownership. When William the Conqueror sort of achieved the land grab of all land grabs, he, in order to appease the peasants, left their sort of cooperative model of land ownership intact, despite the fact that he, you know, essentially took ownership of the land away from those people in ultimate terms.
Yeah, I mean, he was 1066, wasn't it, William the Conqueror? But the previous system was called, I know, the open field system. In villages were really not so much called villages, they were called manors. I mean, they had a lord of the manor that seemed to rule the village, and, you know, that was the kind of part of the feudal system. But practically day to day, how was it different to the way the countryside is managed now?
Well, everybody worked on the land. I mean, it wasn't until, you know, the late 1700s that, you know, the vast majority of people lived in cities and towns. So, you know, everybody essentially was a sort of small-scale family farmer, and you worked on your land and worked your crops certain days of the week, and then you had feudal obligations to work for the lord of the manor on certain days of the week or at certain times of the year, you know, a lot more or a lot less depending on the season. And you know, you were technically a serf, which meant that you were private property of the lord of the manor, so you needed to get his permission to marry, and there were various other sort of, you know, things that, you know, because you were technically owned by this lord, you had to get their permission to be able to do.
Now, there's a book came out, I think it was in the 1960s, called The Tragedy of the Commons, which painted Garrett Hardin was the author, and it painted this picture of, well, it was kind of inevitable that there was going to be mismanagement of the open fields and that there were going to be squabbles and it wasn't really going to work. Do you buy that?
Yeah, no, well, The Tragedy of the Commons basically has been completely disowned by its author and completely ripped apart by the scientific community, and quite how it got published in the scientific journal is something that slightly baffles a lot of people, because it's a very, very flawed piece of work. And as I said, the author who wrote it himself is horrendously embarrassed by it, and a lot of the monstrous things that it's been used to justify by sort of neoliberal you know, politicians, bankers and policymakers. So, you know, I mean, I think even the person who wrote it would be quite happy to rip it up, burn it, or use it to wipe his bum nowadays.
Well, so, you know, basically it wasn't a tragedy, so it wasn't inevitable. What was the process by which, I mean, because many of our ancestors would have been working in these open fields, would have had you know, a much more agrarian style existence. Now we've got this kind of industrial agriculture with some guy in an office in somewhere in a city clicking a mouse and sending in the, you know, the harvest machines or the or planters or, you know, this kind of thing, or harrows into the fields from a distant place. I mean, we've kind of lost that, haven't we? So ultimately, how was it that we came, you know, you can't just persuade people to say, well, hang on a minute, guys, you're going to have to just leave your land and forget about it.
Oh, no, I mean, it was done, you know, very violently. I mean, we, you know, the Highland Clearances is much more within living memory, and the brutality that was with which the Scots were treated in the way they were cleared off their land is still something that, you know, the Scottish national conscience really holds on to today. But I think we've just quite simply had our history erased. And in the Tudor times and even slightly before, you know, literally hundreds of people were cleared off their land in often a day or so. and, you know, were sort of became a migrant, vagrant underclass without land and without any rights. And it's just something that's been, you know, pretty boldly wiped out of our consciousness. And one of the fun things about being a folk singer has been going back and excavating some of that. And you'll be pleased to know that I've been anonymously sent some ballads from, you know, the 15 and 1600s that have never seen the light of day, that, you know, are sort of primary source material and proof of people's resistance to this process of people being cleared off the land.
Well, one of the things that really accelerated the enclosures, the privatisation of our land, was the English Civil War. And that's, again, that's another thing that many of us probably, you know, it'd be difficult to place where it happened historically, which century it happened, the English Civil War, let alone how it affected the acceleration of privatisation of land. So what are your thoughts about the English Civil War and how that fits into how we lost, I suppose, our land rights, the rights to stay on the land?
No, certainly. I think... From the readings that I've had, I think that a considerable amount more land and more damage was done before the English Civil War than people realised, but the English Civil War definitely was the nail in the coffin. When the Spanish discovered, inverted commas, South America and used gunpowder in order to persuade the locals to give them all of their silver, that caused the first European-wide inflation, because suddenly huge amounts of precious metals was dropped into Europe. And that inflation meant that Henry VIII had a lot less money and power than he had previously. So that's really what the dissolution of the monasteries was. It was about Henry VIII trying to shore up his finances by taking all of the church's land and assets. And that was a good short-term boost for him, but he ultimately laid the seeds of defeat for outright monarchy, because he sold off the land to this new sort of capitalist, lawyer, merchant classes who then gained enough power over the next 100 years to directly challenge the monarchy and the Stuart monarchy, and that sparked the English Civil War. So, you know, when you look at that process through the prism of land, it suddenly makes a lot more sense. And the English Civil War has always been, you know, it's not taught even remotely properly. It's kind of spun as this sort of goodies parliament and the people versus the king. But a far more useful way to think about it is, you know, a 1% elite, royalist sort of cavaliers versus a 1% elite, you know, kind of merchant parliamentarians, and the idea that any of them genuinely reflected what the other 98% of the population felt is sort of more stuff of myth than anything else.
We had the levellers and the diggers, didn't we, in the English Civil War? The levellers, to begin with, were amongst the soldiery. I mean, actually, they were soldiers themselves, and they were saying, well, look, you know, if we're going to be fighting for something, we want an army that represents the views of the soldiers who are fighting in it, which was
Absolutely.
Quite an interesting idea. And afterwards, the diggers, who called themselves the true levellers, and the diggers basically squatted land, which was common land, and said, well, this civil war isn't worth anything unless the people get their land back. So what are your thoughts about those two movements, the levellers and the diggers?
No, I mean, the whole English Civil War period is fascinating. One of the reasons why it's most fascinating is because the censorship of the printing press was lifted just before the Civil War. It's the first time that the underdogs, and that we really get a sense of what people were thinking, because so many pamphlets were able to be presented, and therefore you get a really good crystallized understanding of what the levellers and what the diggers felt. But I don't think what they're feeling came out of nothing. I think it existed for quite a long time, but because of the incredibly repressive atmosphere and the censorship that was abound and the lack of access to printing presses, you know, it's only around the time of the English Civil War that we actually start seeing radical literature that we can read and recognise today.
I mean, I've had a look at some of these English Civil War pamphlets. Some of them even the originals from the time, and you get a kind of amazing sense of excitement that some of these printing presses have been liberated. I actually felt it was a little bit like, you know, something like pirate radio was when that first arrived.
No, absolutely, it really was. Yeah, and no, it is, you know, amazing reading those. Those voices. I mean, there's a digger's song from 1649, which is their song that they wrote. And I mean, you know, that's just staggering to think that we can get together and sing something that, you know, radicals and free thinking people were singing in the mid 1600s.
Now, also, people have pointed to the English Civil War as being really the birth of internationally of capitalism, where you've got a whole country which is run on the capitalist system, really run by the merchants, by the bankers.
Absolutely.
And so I guess we've got a bit of a apology to make to the rest of the world.
Yeah, again, you know, the English Civil War has spun as this wonderful thing where suddenly the tyranny of the monarchy was overthrown and we had a lovely parliament. But yeah, it really was, you know, spawning the devil in many, many ways. And once that cat had been let out of the bag and then spread over to America, we were really going down a road that has led to some pretty horrific status quos recently.
One of the things I know, which you know, is anyone that's interested in this starts to get fascinated by, is the idea of land as private property. Because obviously, you know, we talk about it. If you're someone who works in property, you work in land, you work in buildings and houses, and yet that's not the same as property. Say your car or your phone. Can land actually be your private property?
Gosh, that's a big question. I'm not quite sure where I sit on that. I mean, in my heart, I would love to think that private property could be abolished. I think that from what I've got from studying revolutions, and not just about England but revolutions all over the world, is that a lot of the time just trying to make lots of small incremental changes, if it's possible, is infinitely preferable to a massive overthrow of an entire system and trying to, you know, break all those chains in one go. And I'd love to, you know, think that that can and would work, but there aren't many examples of revolutions where that has been successful. Maybe the Haitian revolution is perhaps a good example, but certainly when you look at the American Revolution and the French Revolution, and you know, I've been studying Roman history quite a bit recently, a lot of the time when there is a sudden, you know, just splitting of all of the chains, the counter-revolutionary forces that come into play as a result of that do lead to an enormous amount of chaos and misery for a lot of people for a very long time. So, you know, would I want to get rid of private property? Yes. Would I want to just wave, you know, would I want a revolution tomorrow that made that happen? I'd love it, but I'm not sure that I think, you know, if we can make incremental changes towards that, knowing that that's the goal, that's more healthy.
Now, you know, you said earlier, history is written by the winners, or words to that effect anyway. And I mean, there's another great quote from Winston Churchill, isn't there? History will be kind to me, I know, because I shall write it.
Yes.
If those peasants who were removed from the land, kicked off the land, many of whom couldn't read or write, actually had their voice, what do you think they'd be saying to us today?
I think a really strong notion at that time was in the idea of a person's birthright. And I think that we all have a right to resources, and, you know, you could take that in the form of land, but, you know, it's got to the point now where there's a lot of demonizing people on benefits and welfare state. But actually, if you look back at where that all came out of, you know, part of people being cleared off their land and the parliamentary enclosures was this promise that, basically, look, we're taking your land away from you, but the new wealth that's going to create for us as a society will mean that we will always be able to support you in your time of need. So, you know, you see in a lot of folk songs this lyric, you know, England must pay us what she owes. And the fact that that's been forgotten and now people get demonized because they fall on hard times and they need the support of the country, I think is really atrocious.
There's also the word dole, isn't there? I remember looking that up years ago in Oxford from an old version of the Encyclopaedia Britannica from, God, the 1500s or something, early 1600s. And it said that the dole originally was a part or portion, most commonly of a meadow, where several persons have shares. So there's this kind of understanding, I think, that as people are removed from the land, their connection with the land is severed, that they become dependent, don't they, on the money system. And, of course, the money system at the moment, we keep being told, is in crisis.
Absolutely. No, it's true. And I hope that, you know, we'll see this general election a major shake-up of the political system. And, you know, this will allow some much more meaningful and badly needed reforms to happen, certainly in terms of the way that voting is done and also in terms of being able to recall MPs who, you know, turn out to be crooks.
You've also hit the headlines over the last few days, haven't you? Actually, in the national press. How did you manage to do that?
I was trying to get away from London and find a bit of peace and quiet, and I ended up in a small sleepy town at exactly the same time as David Cameron, who was making his first public walkabout during the general election. And I did what any folk singer would do. I got out my instrument, I got out a ukulele I had with me, and just started singing a protest song at him. And it got filmed and was on ITV News, Channel 4 News, BBC Radio, and the video of it has had a third of a million hits in the last week.
Well, well done. And I think maybe the best thing for us to do is to seek that out and play it after this interview on the show. Just remind us how people can find your plays or your shows that you do, and so we can see if there's one happening round this way, and if not, maybe even travel out for the weekend one Saturday or Sunday and see it.
Perfect. So my name's Robin Gray, G-R-E-Y, and if you go to robingray.com, there's lots of information there. But if you specifically want to know about the show 3 Acres and a Cow, that's 3acresandacow.co.uk, or Google it and it will come up.
Okay, so what was the song you were singing?
It's got a rude word in it. Am I allowed to? Am I allowed rude words on this podcast?
You can bleep it if you wish.
Okay. The song was Blit off back to Eton, Blit off back to Eton, Blit off back to Eton with all your Eton chums. Dinner at a food bank, dinner at a food bank, dinner at a food bank for all your Tory chums. 'Cause you sell the NHS, you sell the NHS, you sell the NHS to all your Tory chums. Won't you blit off back to Eton, blit off back to Eton, blit off back to Eton with all your Tory chums. That kind of thing.
Well done, Robin Gray. Thanks ever so much for joining us on
That's okay.
on Dialect. And good luck with your show.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks, Robin. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.